No, it was built in 2007, so it's like about 10 years.
That's cool.
All rise. The judges of the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, draw near. The court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. The court is called to order. The court calls the case of United States versus Master Sergeant Richard D. Collins, number ACM 39296. In today's oral argument, we consider whether the statute of limitation in Article 43 UCMJ had run, where the alleged offense of rape of an adult woman was not punishable by death, and the charges were not preferred until over 15 years after the incident occurred. Appellant's counsel, you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. 5 minutes, please.
Very well. You may proceed.
Thank you, Judge. Good morning, members of the court. Senior Judge Johnson, Judge Mink, Judge Dennis, always a pleasure to appear before the court. The statute of limitations in Article 43 UCMJ had run where the alleged offense of rape of an adult woman was not punishable by death and the charges were not preferred, until after over 15 years after the incident occurred. I'd like to start with the standard of review and then sort of go through the history of the case law that brings us to where we are and then apply that to the facts of this case. The standard of review for questions concerning the applicability of a statute of limitations is a question of law reviewed de novo. That is United States versus McElhaney. The statute of limitations in 2000, an accused is subject to the statute of limitations in force at time of the offense. At the time, Article 120 UCMJ authorized maximum punishment was death or such other punishment as a court-martial may direct. Article 43 of the UCMJ said any offense punishable by death may be tried without limitation, however, if not liable to be tried if the offense was committed more than 5 years. So in other words, death penalty cases could be tried at any time. Now, how does that bring us to where we are now? The evolution of the interpretation of the statute of limitations for rape. Willenbring versus Neurauter, the initial case from 1998 from our Superior Court, held that the relevant inquiry was not whether the government could actually impose the death penalty, but whether it was, quote, authorized, unquote, by Article 120. In United States versus Stebbins, in 2005, the CAF explicitly held that rape is an offense punishable by death for the purposes of exempting it from the 5-year statute of limitations of Article 43. This, of course, all changed this year. In United States versus Mangahas, this year, the court applied Coker v. Georgia in the case. Supreme Court case holding the death penalty for rape of an adult is unconstitutional and overruled both Willenbring and Stebbins and held that where the death penalty could never be imposed for the offense charge, death was not an authorized punishment under Article 43 UCMJ. So that gets us to where we are today, members of the court. I'd like to address two issues, the first of those issues being waiver. Waiver, as this court knows, requires the intentional relinquishment of a known right and must be consciously and knowingly made, and that's the Harcrow decision from CAF in 2008. The law at the time of the alleged offense was that there was no statute of limitations, but United States versus Hoffman, which we cite in our brief, also decided by CAF this year, said that we do not construe the failure to object to what was the settled law at the time as an intentional relinquishment of a known right, and that is also cited in United States v. Sweeney. The only discussion in this case involving the statute of limitations involved that of lesser included offenses. There was no intentional relinquishment of a known right in this case, and therefore no waiver. Which brings us to forfeiture. Forfeiture is reviewed for plain error. The timing of this case is very important. There are three parts to that. The first is under Harcrow, where the law at the time of trial was settled and clearly contrary to the law at the time of appeal, it is enough that error is plain at the time of appeal. And that's Harcrow on page 14 of our reply brief. It was clearly settled at the time of trial that there was no statute of limitation for rape. The binding decision in Mangahas was clearly contrary to Willenbring and Stebbins. Which brings us finally to the retroactive application of the new rule. And the court said, Judge Ryan's dissent in Harcrow and then cited in McMurrin is that this court must sort of act on three fictions or engage in three fictions. The first of those is that Mangahas had been decided at the time of trial. The second is that the appellant would not have forfeited that right had he known. And the third is that the military judge would have erroneously denied a motion to dismiss. Which brings us to the facts of this case.
Counsel, if I can interject just for a second. In Judge Ryan's concurrence that you're referring to there on the second aspect, when she uses the word forfeit, does she mean forfeit or does she really mean waiver?
I think she means waiver. But now we apply the plain error doctrine to the facts of this case. There was error. The statute of limitations at the time of the offense was 5 years. It was irrelevant that the appellant did not make a motion to dismiss because such a motion would have been futile. And in fact, this court can imagine a trial scenario in which the appellant objected to every single decision by the military judge, even if the law was completely settled as to the decision of the military judge, simply to preserve the error for appeal. Such a, not only would it be fruitless, it would be frivolous. Judge Mink?
Counsel.
Yes, sir.
But that's exactly what happened in Mangahas, right? It wasn't futile for Mangahas to raise the statute of limitations as a defense in that in their case.
He certainly was not futile in his case, no, sir.
In fact, that was the basis upon which CAF decided that case, right?
Correct, Your Honor. But the case law also says, and we'll get to that in a minute, that the military judge has a duty to explain the statute of limitations. And it's very unique under RCM 907 B2 that the military judge has a duty to explain the statute of limitations under RCM 907 if it appears the accused is unaware of that right. So Judge Mink, in response to your question, even if Mangahas had not raised the statute of limitation defense, it would have been incumbent upon the military judge, as it was in this case, to raise that issue.
But didn't the judge recognize, or at least the counsel recognized, that there was a statute of limitations defense with respect to any LIOs, so they weren't ignorant of the statute of limitations as an issue in the case, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor, which I think is what helps, that actually inures to the appellant's benefit in this case, because they were ignorant of the statute of limitations defense as it relates to the main and the only charged offense in the case, as opposed to the lesser included offenses.
But again, in Mangahas, they weren't ignorant to that. Correct?
That's
correct.
And
they raised the issue. The state of the law was the same at the trial for Mangahas and at the trial of your client. But they raised it and your client didn't. Is that correct?
Well, then that really puts the court into, the government into one of two boxes, Your Honor. If this court finds that Collins waived the statute of limitations, then obviously his defense counsel was ineffective for not having raised it at trial and the defense for not advising him on it. In responding to the IAC claim, the government would then have to take one of two positions. First, that there was no IAC because Collins' attorneys advised him correctly based on the law at the time, or two, Collins' attorney did misadvise him on the statute of limitations and he should have objected, in which case his counsel committed IAC. So under whether this court views it under the prism of IAC or what we believe to be the correct prism of there was no of plain error, it still inures to the benefit of the accused. The military judge has an affirmative obligation to advise an accused of the right to assert the statute of limitations and must determine that any waiver of the statute of limitations is both knowing and voluntary, and that's the Thompson case from 2003 from CAF. It is not enough that an accused understood his right to assert a statute of limitations defense generally. The military judge was required to make clear in the record of trial that an accused knew that he had the right to raise the statute of limitations as a bar to prosecution and that he voluntarily gave up that right, and that's the Moore case.
So, counsel, so is that the plain error in this case, the
it
judge's
is,
failure
Honor.
To inquire?
Yes, Your Honor.
So let me ask you this. If, assuming for purposes of argument, that we agreed with the government that the judge didn't err by failing to further inquire, would your client still prevail?
That the judge did not err? Did I hear you correctly, Ron?
Correct. If we assume for purposes of argument, is there another way in this case that your client would prevail under the law?
Well, then I think I go back to the answer that I provided to Judge Mink, which is that his counsel was ineffective for not raising the issue himself. In other words, there's two ways to look at this equation, both of which inure to the benefit of the accused. Now, the government cites to the supplemental authority, as supplemental authority to the analysis of the rules, demonstrating that that at no time does the burden of proof of raising the statute of limitations defense shift from the defense to the military judge. But that interpretation, clearly conflicts with the plain language of RCM 907B2 Bravo and the cases which interpret the rule, including the Thompson case. So the error was plain or obvious in light of Mangahas. Mangahas says that the statute of limitations is 5 years. We apply the law at the time of the appeal. That plain error materially prejudiced the appellant's right to assert the bar to prosecution. The statute of limitations would have prevented both the conviction and the punishment in this case. The government appears to argue that there is no prejudice because the appellant might have had a reason not to raise the statute of limitations. The government incorrectly claims that there was no statute of limitations on the state charges. As we have shown, there was. It was 10 years at the time, and it had run. But even if one puts that aside and assumes arguendo that there was no statute of limitations under state law, even if it hadn't run, an accused doesn't get to elect between forums. That's not his choice. That was up to the state and to the federal government, and the state had declined prosecution in this case. And in fact, it was unlikely in the extreme that the state would have charged him, given that it had destroyed all of the DNA evidence in this case. Finally, Your Honors, I would like to address one final matter raised by the government, which is the Masacchio case cited by the government for the proposition that only the defense can put the statute of limitations in issue. It is clearly distinguishable from the facts of this case. It involved both a different set of facts and a different statute. The defendant had in that case had a valid statute of limitations argument and waived and failed to raise it at trial, It did not involve a later invalidated interpretation of the statute. In other words, the statute of limitations was known to all at the time of trial. Intervening changes in the law can create an exceptional circumstance that overcomes waiver, and that's the Ellis Bureau case from CAP in 2014 that we cite.
But counsel, is Masacchio actually deciding waiver? Is that really what they're deciding? Or are they just saying that the statute of limitations can only come into play once an appellant, a defendant, introduces it?
Right. I think it's the latter, Your Honor, which is the exact opposite of the law under RCM 907, which says that the military judge has a sua sponte obligation to raise it.
Upon motion of the accused?
Not under RCM 907, no, Your Honor. The statute cited by the government in, and I'm sure I'm butchering this poor gentleman's name, but Masacchio, 18 U.S.C. 3282 does not place an affirmative duty on the military, on the judge, to bring a statute of limitation to the attention of the accused. RCM 907 does. Finally, Masacchio is not binding because it involved a completely different statute and because Congress has given the president the authority to prescribe rules for court-martial and place the affirmative obligation on the military judge. Your Honors, I am way ahead of schedule, but that is the only thing subject to questions from the members of the court. That is all the matters from the appellant.
I do have a question. So is there any significance to the fact that this case involves a non-constitutional matter, unlike cases that are retroactively applying constitutional issues like Hills or Crawford?
I would argue a couple of different things, Your Honor. First off, I think this case does involve a constitutional matter. I don't think it's any different. I mean, illegal punishment is violative of the Eighth Amendment, so arguably it does involve a constitutional matter. And statutes of limitations do have constitutional implications. But if you look at the cases we cited in our brief, specifically those cases related to sentencing guidelines on the federal side, the retroactive applicability of, when a case is decided, the retroactive applicability of that case to cases in the appellate pipeline, which we discuss in our brief, does not depend on the constitutionality or whether it is an interpretation, a statutory interpretation. Although I believe in this case it is arguably both.
Counsel, you know, going back, you mentioned Mangahas's overturning Willembring, and part of the reason that they overturned it was because of Willembring's failure to comply essentially with the Supreme Court precedent in Coker, right?
Yes, ma'am.
So here we have in Collins, at least my understanding of the government's argument in their brief is that Collins, because of his failure to raise this at trial, to find that Mangahas applies would be inconsistent with Masacchio. So wouldn't we be obligated under the Mangahas theory of complying with Supreme Court precedent, wouldn't we be obligated to view Masaccio as binding on this case?
Masaccio is not binding because it applies to a completely different statute. And in the statute in question in Masaccio, there was no obligation on the part of the trial judge to bring matters of the statute of limitations to the attention of the accused. There's also another big difference as to why Masaccio is not applicable to this case, which is that the statute of limitations in our case changed post-trial. That is not the facts of Masaccio. The facts of the statute of limitations were known at the time of trial to the participants in Masaccio, and they elected not to raise it. So for those two reasons, it is neither binding nor applicable from a factual standpoint.
But doesn't the holding of Masaccio basically, when you break it down, doesn't it basically say that if you don't raise a statute of limitations issue at trial, you can't raise it for the first time on appeal?
Under that particular statute, that is correct. But that is not the statute that is applicable in this case. In our case, the statute puts an affirmative duty on the military judge to raise that issue at trial. So I don't think it stands for the broad proposition that if it's not raised at trial, it's waived forever and ever. And again, Your Honor, if one were to take that position, then the simple, clear implication of that is that the defense counsel were ineffective for not bringing the matter up at trial.
So I'd like to go back to your points about ineffective assistance of counsel.
Yes, sir.
Because you articulate that would be the alternative basis for appellant to prevail in this case if we agree with the government's points about 907. But could you explain to me more about why appellant would necessarily prevail? Because would it be failing to meet the performance expected of fallible lawyers to not bring a motion that appeared to not have merit underneath the prevailing law at the time?
Again, Your Honors, if the court finds that it was not plain error on the part of the court, and if the court finds that, the only way to do that in the appellant's position is for the court to find that an appellant has a duty to, appellant counsel has a duty to raise every issue at trial, regardless of whether or not the law is settled at that time.
Well, not every issue, but just affirmative defenses.
No, it could be theoretically every issue. I mean, theoretically, an accused could, counsel could object to when the government counsel brings out, put out an absurd example, Your Honor. Let's say that the trial counsel puts out a statement by the accused, and the defense says, objection, that's hearsay. Well, the law is settled that a statement of an accused is not hearsay. So there would be no reason to make that objection. But if the court finds that it was not plain error, then the only fallback that the government can look upon is that the defense counsel should raise every single defense, affirmative defense, or every single evidentiary objection at trial, regardless of whether it is settled law. And frankly, Your Honors, in some cases, such actions would be sanctionable as frivolous. But if that is the alternate position that the government wishes to take, then the defense counsel was ineffective for not doing what the defense counsel did in Willenbring and raising the statute of limitations defense.
So you don't see a middle ground there between what a trial defense counsel might reasonably expect to be a successful argument, perhaps not today, but at some point in the future, and then bringing every conceivable objection that they might bring, whether it's supported by the current law or not.
Well, I think if the court looks at the significant changes in military law in the last 5 years, Fossler, Hills, these were all issues that everybody assumed were well settled at trial. And CAF, changed the law, for lack of a better term. And so to be able to predict which of those might cause the CAF to change the law would require a defense counsel to, one, be a lot smarter than I am, and to be omniscient. And so the only way to make sure that you've covered all your bases is simply to object to every single statement or ruling made at the trial level, which would clearly grind the administration of justice to a halt.
So would that really become the standard of performance that we would expect for a trial defense counsel?
If one were to adopt the government's position, yes. Subject to any further questions by the members of the court? Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. Government counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Senior Judge Johnson, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Captain Mike Bunnell, Ms. Mary Ellen Payne, and I represent the United States in this proceeding. The statute of limitations is an available defense. An appellant did not avail himself of it. As such, this court should affirm the findings and sentence for three reasons. First, if you don't preserve this issue at trial, you lose it on appeal. Second, plain error review cannot salvage that omission. And three, even if it could, under the facts of this case, there was no error, plain or otherwise. Now, at the outset, as a threshold matter, the statute of limitations is technically a defense. And this is an important distinction, and it's a unique defense, so I think it merits some discussion and an operational definition. Generally speaking, there are two types of defenses, those that bar guilt and those that bar trial. We're usually pretty familiar with, we just heard some of the examples of the types of objections that would lead to a defense of guilt. These are things like not guilty because he was obeying an order, was acting in self-defense, or mistaken about consent. There are myriad types of affirmative defenses, and a non-exhaustive list can be found in RCM 916. The statute of limitations does not belong to this category. It exists in a separate world over here that we call defenses against trial, meaning we don't even address the question of guilt. We're saying you can't even prosecute this case. And importantly, the drafters of the MCM in Appendix 21, when dealing with RCM 916, they said, listen, these are different both conceptually and procedurally. And that's an important distinction. That's their language, conceptually and procedurally, meaning there are rules for 916 types of defenses, and there are rules for 907 types of defenses. So in this limited universe that we're operating within of 907, that's what the analysis that we need to begin with. Now, to my first point, that if you don't preserve this issue at trial, you lose it on appeal, that comes directly from 907. Under B2, it explicitly says, as we've heard from Judge Dennis, that if you don't, that the accused has the burden upon motion by the accused to raise the statute of limitations defense. And this is what the court took up in Masaccio, this idea of preservation. And that case is important for loads of reasons, but I want to highlight the analogous relationship between this case and that. So there, the defense raised two issues. They raised a jurisdictional issue, saying you can't even bring the statute of limitations defense because it's jurisdictional and it can't be lost. But they said, alternatively, this needs to be reviewed for plain error because somebody should have brought it to the attention of the defense that the statute of limitations has run in this case. Importantly, the Supreme Court, quote, disagreed with both points. And it said unequivocally, quote, a defendant cannot successfully raise the statute of limitations defense for the first time on appeal. And this is exactly...
I'm sorry to interrupt, counsel, but to that end, the Supreme Court also talked about the extensive jurisprudence that reaffirmed this notion. I mean, essentially that the statute of limitations bar had often been required to be presented by an appellant, which is different than our jurisprudence because in Salter and a number of other cases, we have held an affirmative duty, we have placed an affirmative duty on a military judge before a bar to the statute of limitations could be waived by an appellant. Isn't that a significant distinction between our jurisprudence and Masaccio?
Yes and no, Your Honor. So it is a distinction. So 907B2B does make that distinction for a military judge's responsibilities, but it is different than... What it says and what it doesn't say can be confused. What it actually says under the law there is that if it appears that the accused is unaware of his right to assert the statute of limitations defense, it does not say if it appears that the accused is unaware that the statute of limitations has run. And this is supported, this idea is supported by the drafters themselves. If we turn to Appendix 21 of the MCM, it says there explicitly, this is their language, when citing Rule 801, D, which is, by the way, the heading there is military judges' responsibilities. So in dealing with whether there's a sua sponte duty, this is what the drafters had to say. They said, although the defense may have the burden of raising an issue, for example, the statute of limitations, Once it is done so, the prosecution may bear the burden of persuasion. That's indicative, right? Again, we live in this world where we're not dealing with a defense about guilt. We're dealing with a defense about time. So if we're going to give somebody a pass and say, you may very well be guilty, but we're going to give you a pass, they have the affirmative duty to raise that. It doesn't create a parade of horribles where we're worried about raising myriad issues all the time. There are two. In 907B2, there are two things, both of which relate to timing, RCM 707, speedy trial, and statute of limitations.
Well, doesn't Salter indicate pretty strongly that the military judge has an obligation based on the facts as they appear to the judge in that case that the statute of limitations, which is a complete defense to the charge, would apply in this case? And that the accused is knowingly and voluntarily not raising that defense?
Well, yes, Your Honor, I want to distinguish a little bit. I don't think it's just Salter. I think virtually most of the cases decided by the defense. So we have, I think you can make a case that Weidman and Troxell, Sweeney, Salter, Rogers, Thompson, and Moore stand for this proposition that you really need to waive this. However, all of those are anachronistic for this argument because they're pre-Masaccio. So in Masaccio, again, I come back to that because this is an important case. They had the same issue arising that we see in military courts. They were dealing with, hey, is this waiver? Some circuits were dealing with it as this is affirmative waiver when people fail to raise the statute of limitations defense. And some were looking at it like, no, this is forfeiture and merits plain error review. What Masaccio was saying is we're going to step back from this. We're getting out of that business. We don't care whether it was waiver or forfeiture. It's not a part of the case if you don't bring it up at trial.
So to make sure I'm understanding your argument, Masaccio stands for the proposition that it's not a waiver analysis and it's not a plain error analysis. It's something else.
Correct.
Isn't it a fair reading of Masaccio, though, that it is a plain error analysis? It's just one that an appellant is never going to prevail on because the court's not going to find it was plain error where the judge didn't have an obligation to bring it up himself.
I can see that reading, Your Honor, but the problem is they literally say there is no error. And that's why they say it's not a part of the case. So to say it's a plain error analysis, they're saying there is no error to review.
But appellant's arguing that the essential difference here, the plain error here, is based in RCM 907, which obviously didn't apply in Masaccio.
Correct, and so there is that little wrinkle of 907B2B saying that in the event that you are unaware that you have the right to assert a defense for timing, not for guilt, then the military judge has a duty to step in and say, okay, I've heard you complain about the timing. You know that you can challenge this. And for all of the reasons laid out by Judge Mink, that is that Mangahos didn't change this piece of the law. Langahos changed what it changed. It said no longer is it an indefinite period, it's a 5-year period. It did nothing to the procedural requirements to preserve an issue.
Well, what about Judge Ryan's concurrence in Harcrow, where we go back and we imagine the legal fictions that she postulates that, in fact, it wouldn't have been forfeited at the time, or it wouldn't have been waived at the time, if you want to make that reading of it. And we have to assume that the judge made an incorrect ruling and go from there on a plain error analysis.
So if we apply retroactively the law at the time, if we adopt the Harcrow rule, that doesn't really change Mangahos. Mangahos is what it is. It explicitly said, hey, listen, there's a non-constitutional question here. We can go around what this court decided in Mangahos as far as due process goes, and we can just grab the fact that they raised this issue at trial. And in fact, in Judge Ryan's opinion there, in the introductory section, they emphasize the fact that this was preserved at trial. That's not my emphasis, that's theirs. They say they can get it because they preserved this issue at trial. So what is Harcrow applying? It's not applying anything. It's just applying the fact that, yeah, you can't be prosecuted for, it's only applying the time window, not the procedural requirements to preserve the issue.
So in other words, if this trial, an appellant's case, had happened today, when Mangahos is known to be the law, there would be no plain error if the judge did exactly the same thing and didn't ask the appellant whether he was aware that there was a statute of limitations defense, which would be a complete defense to the only charge and specification against him, where he was pleading not guilty, that would not be a plain error.
Correct. So let me make sure I understand your question, but what I think you're saying is if we had the facts of today's case and there appeared to be no reason to think that they didn't know that they had the right to assert a statute of limitations defense and the judge didn't bring it up sua sponte, is that correct?
Well, no appearance other than the fact that it was obviously a defense that would apply, and for some reason they weren't raising it.
Yeah, so again, if they understood, if they manifest as they did in this case on the record, that they understood what's going on and they gave no indication, because again, the language of the RCM says, if it appears, meaning I think that we need to look for something that suggests that they are unaware, that the default is that they are aware.
Now, counsel, I just want to clarify something there, because I understand your analysis of the plain language or your interpretation of the plain language, but it seems inconsistent with the plain language of CAF in Salter. And I understand that Salter was pre-Masaccio, but 907 hasn't really changed. And their interpretation of 907 is whenever it appears that the statute of limitations has run against an offense, the fact will be brought to the attention of the accused. That's CAF's interpretation of 907. And so that's different than, let me see if he brings up statute of limitations as it pertains to an LIO. This is a very affirmative, a very clear affirmative obligation placed on a military judge whenever it appears that the statute has run, regardless of the understanding of the appellant.
So, ma'am, if I understand your position, you're saying if accepting my interpretation of RCM 907B2B, then in that case, existing case law say that we have to proceed? Is that the question?
No, the question, what I'm asking is, I think, how is your interpretation consistent with CAF's opinion in Salter? How is your interpretation of 907B2 consistent with CAF's interpretation of 907B2 in Salter?
Well, ma'am, I don't think it is consistent. I rely on Masaccio. I think Masaccio changed the landscape. Okay. And again, there's no reason to think that it wouldn't. We heard in the appellant's brief that they cited United States versus Tunnell, but I think that's just an opposite to the analysis. What that proposition stands for is they were saying, hey, listen, 18 U.S.C., 3282, doesn't track exactly with our code in Article 43, and so it's not binding. But the problem is in that same opinion, they say there are sections where they do track exactly, like subsection F. And so those are binding. And so the real question that they were dealing with in that case is, hey, listen, we're trying to compute the time necessary for a statute of limitations defense. And in the military, we have unique considerations because people can be in absentia, that sometimes people are just gone and the statute of limitations can run if they're deployed or if they are on a mission somewhere and they get a pass because we couldn't arraign them. And so the court said, well, that's why we changed these rules here and that's why they're different. None of those considerations are in play for this issue of what the procedural requirements of preserving a statute of limitations defense. The other thing, I know this is a bit late, but CAF's opinion last night on Williams also lends itself to an alternative argument for the government. And that is that if there was error, it wasn't plain error. Because here the situation is, CAF is basically saying, listen, we are not sure whether this applies retroactively. They were unwilling to summarily dismiss the case in Williams, even though it happened from 2000 to 2003. They were unwilling to say these are per se barred. But even if they weren't, it lends itself to the argument that if there was an error, it wasn't a plain error for the military judge to figure out. And again, it doesn't relieve them of their burden to bring the motion itself.
Do you know if in Williams issue of statute of limitations have been raised at trial?
I don't know, Your Honor, and I'm sorry, I just haven't had time to.
So you don't know if the first time it was raised was on appeal?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
And counsel, to switch tracks a little bit, can you articulate a plausible reason why the appellant would have knowingly waived a statute of limitations defense in this case?
I don't know why they would have. I don't see a reason. There could be reasons. That doesn't mean because I can't imagine that they're not there, but I don't have one off the tip of my fingers as to why they wouldn't. And I think that, again, that doesn't speak to the lack of burden there. Again, we're dealing with giving them a pass. This is very different.
But isn't this one of the essential differences here is that in Masaccio, the applicability of the statute of limitations was clear under the prevailing law. In this case, it was not. The prevailing law was 180 degrees against bringing such a motion.
Yes, but it doesn't change the fact that it still needs to be preserved for what it is. So just because the law changed and the statute of limitations appears to have run under, if we apply Mangahas retroactively, That doesn't change. I mean, then it puts us back into the same position that Masaccio is in, where it looks like the statute is passed. I mean, there, the defense, it had run. Nobody raised it, and they pressed forward anyway and said, too bad, so sad, you didn't raise it on at trial. The same situation would be here, right? So if we're applying retroactively, the military judge would presumably have known under Harcrow, yeah, this was a problem. But there's no indication that they actually didn't understand their right to assert the defense itself. If there are no other questions, may I briefly conclude?
I do have another question. So what about Article 66C? All right, in this case where it appears that in light of Mangahas, there was a complete defense available to the only charge and specification against the appellant, could we look past forfeiture or waiver or whatever else there is in light of Masaccio and exercise our authority to grant relief?
I think that you have the ability to, Your Honor. I don't think that's the right outcome under Article 66C. Because again, the idea there is to promote the administration of justice. And what we have here is a conviction, a rightful conviction of a violent rape, in which it appears that they had the legal basis, all of the foundational case law was existent as it was in Mangahas, and they could have asserted that right, and we would be giving them a pass and doing justice a disservice by allowing them to walk away scot-free. And so, yes, does the Article 66 power extend to that type of relief? Probably. But should it apply, and do you have the discretion to not use that? Absolutely. Thank you. If I can briefly conclude, the statute of limitations is a defense. It is an available defense, and appellant did not avail himself of it. Nothing in the rules or in the case law post-Masaccio relieves appellant of his obligation to raise this issue at trial. Mangahas changed the statute of limitations window for rape, not the procedures in which to preserve the issue on appeal. Appellant did not raise this issue at trial, and therefore, as Martinez put it, not even plain error review can come to the rescue. This court should affirm the findings and sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Judge. Judge Dennis, I'd like to get back to a point that you raised. As I was sitting at my table, I thought about the Solario case, which some of us are old enough to remember. I'm unfortunately one of those, of the days in which an accused could not be tried unless his offense was, quote, service-connected. The law is now well settled that there is no service-connected requirement. If you were to take the government's arguments to its extreme, the defense would have to raise a lack of service connection in those cases in which it was applicable at every trial, even though the law is well settled, because who knows? At some point in the future, CAF or the Supreme Court, in this case, could overrule Solario. That is clearly not the law. Judge Johnson, Senior Judge Johnson, you pointed out the affirmative duty as to, I'd like to spend some time discussing why this case is not analogous to Masaccio. One is the affirmative duty placed on the military judge under RCM 907. The manual has been changed numerous times since Masaccio came out. At no point has the president changed the requirement of a military judge under RCM 907 to bring this matter affirmatively to the attention of the accused. As a result, one can assume that, aware of Masaccio, the president has decided that it is either inapplicable or that the president wishes for the statute of limitations requirement under RCM 907 to remain the law. And both, and I think the important case in this, Your Honor, the two important cases are Thompson and Harcrow. In Harcrow, the law was well settled as it related to the United States versus Crawford. In Harcrow, the appellant did not object at trial under confrontation clause. But the CAF clearly said that they can raise that issue for the first time on appeal. And the other big distinguishing factor between this case and Masaccio is that the law at trial in Masaccio was the same as it was on appeal. Here, the law at trial is very different from the law as it was on appeal. And finally, Your Honors, while I've only had about 30, 60 seconds to look at the Williams case, I would like to address it. It appears, at least on first blush, And Your Honor, Judge Mink, I actually do know that case, and it was my recollection that the appellant did not raise the statute of limitations issue at trial. I could be wrong. Ask my wife. I'm wrong a lot. But the other issue is, Your Honors, it appears that the CAF affirmed the charge that was allegedly convicted in 2007. Because if you look at it, they talk about the physical injuries. So it appears that CAF affirmed a charge in 2007 and for that was preferred in 2011, which would certainly explain why they said, take a look at this, tell us whether or not Mangahas is applicable, because you know there might be a close call with regards to the dates. But at least on first reading of the case, I wanted to bring that to the court's attention, that it appears like the one charge that they did affirm was preferred within the five-year period of the limitations, and that those charges that were not preferred within the five-year period of the limitations were dismissed. Subject to any further questions from the members of the court, that concludes my presentation.
Well, just one point on
yes,
Williams.
Sir.
And it appears from a reading of Williams that the rehearing that they were authorizing was on the specification that dealt with an offense between 2000 and 2003, which was more than 5 years before the trial. Since the statute of limitations issue was raised, at least on the appellate level, wouldn't it have been just as easy if they believed it applied to those offenses to have dismissed it at that point?
Well, again, Your Honor, I've only looked at my understanding is that the charge that they affirmed was the one that was allegedly committed in 2007.
No, I understand. The one that they authorized, that they overturned and authorized a rehearing on, and made reference to Mangahas, and the statute of limitations issue was an offense that occurred in the early 2000s.
Your Honor, I simply don't know the facts of the case well enough to opine on that.
Thank
I think in this case, one of the big differences in this case would be that if you do the math, I think you said 2003, Your Honor. I think that the statute was changed in 2006, and so maybe that may be the Mangahas issue that the court is referring to. Whereas in our case, it was still outside of that 5 years. But again, Your Honor, I just looked at the case for 30 to 60 seconds this morning, and I'm probably not making any sense as a result of that.
Well, you bring up a good point. Do you think that the fact that the Congress changed the law in 2006 to specifically say that there was an unlimited statute of limitations in a rape case like the appellant's case, does that have any bearing on the statute of limitations that would have applied or should have applied in 2000?
No, because it was more than 5 years. I mean, even if one were to buy that argument, which I don't think is the argument that the CAF is making, please, you know, again, I haven't looked at it well enough to know. But as to why they may have remanded it to take a look at whether or not a rehearing is authorized on those charges, that may be part of the logic. I certainly don't know what the judges were thinking. But even if that's true, that logic would be inapplicable in this case. Subject to any questions from the members of the court? Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Counsel, thank you both for your arguments. The court will render a decision in due course. The court is now closed.
All rise.